This week on Interchain FM, we're speaking to Kate Sills. Kate is a software engineer at Agoric Systems, working on various frameworks and tools for secure smart contract development. In particular, the Electronic Rights Transfer Protocol, ERTP, and Zoe, into which we will delve in detail in the first half of this episode. The Agoric company is one of the founding members of the IBC Steering Committee and has been instrumental in the specification and development of the protocol. And we'll discuss Agoric's testnet and what role in the Interchain ecosystem a future mainnet might play. Kate has also written on the intersection of technology, society, and law for libertarianism.org and on her blog at caitlinsills.com. And in the second half of this episode, we explore the relationship between law enforcement and smart contracts and brainstorm several different ways smart contracts might be used to help fund public goods. Several source papers and documents are referenced in this episode. You can find links to all of them in the show notes. Enjoy.
So, hi, Kate from Agoric. Could you go ahead and do a brief introduction about what got you excited about blockchains, how you got into smart contracts, and how you joined Agoric?
First, thank you so much for having me. I started out doing computer science at UC Berkeley just as an undergrad. But at the time, like early in college, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer, and that was really interesting to me. So I took like some constitutional law classes, but it kind of didn't seem like being a lawyer was a great career choice. People seemed really unhappy, you know, becoming lawyers. And so I kind of put that in the back of my mind and just did regular software engineering and website building, things like that. But then I started hearing about Bitcoin, and around 2013 started getting really, really interested in Bitcoin, but only really in terms of like, you know, buying it and holding it. I wasn't really getting too much into the software part of it. And then when Ethereum came out, they started talking about these things that they were calling smart contracts. Given, you know, my previous interests in the law, that really, really started to interest me. And I think like on the Ethereum homepage, it was like, you can build your own democracy and you can, you know, build your own board voting system, like, you know, board of directors voting system. There are just like all of these really interesting use cases that I had never really explored before. So from there, I started going really deep, started reading Nick Szabo's original smart contracts papers, started coming up with my own theories. And then I think it was at a Rebooting the Web of Trust. I was kind of spewing my ideas about smart contracts on someone. And they're like, you know what? The person that you really need to meet is Mark Miller over there. And they like kind of like dragged me along. And I started, you know, telling Mark about all my ideas. And he said, oh, well, yeah, that's right. And, you know, I've written this paper that you should really read. It's called The Digital Path. And so like that kind of opened up my eyes to the fact that people had been thinking about smart contracts for a really long time. And in addition to Nick Szabo, there was this community that was talking about these things that included like Mark Miller, who is currently the chief scientist at Agoric, the company that I work for, and Ian Grigg and others. And they had been thinking about these things for a long time, but not in the context of a blockchain. At that point, it was, you know, this is something that you might run on a trusted third-party computer, you know, and maybe that's pretty hazardous, but that's kind of the best you can do. So after I talked to Mark and, you know, started doing more and more research, you know, I was finding these papers of his, trying to build on those ideas. And that kind of got me into the Agoric network. And they were like, you know what, we can, let's hire this person. So I was really pleased to join them and, you know, be able to work on these problems together with them. At this point, I'm a software engineer working for Agoric and working on some of the more of like the smart contract layer and more of like the, what I would call like the economic and legal issues.
And just for some context to give our listeners, can you provide a premise for what the digital path is?
Yeah. So I think Mark had originally, he had just read Hernando de Soto's book about how in countries that kind of have a poor legal infrastructure, it's really, really hard for people to actually have property title to their property. Like even if they seem to own it and everyone around them would agree that they own it, there's still not the legal infrastructure there for them to be sure that they have this property in the future. And because they don't have the proper documentation for their property title, they can't get business loans or anything like that with their property being used as collateral. So Hernando de Soto's point in this book, Mystery of Capital, was that this lack of property title really affects how likely it is that these people are able to have all of the economic activity that we kind of take for granted. So Mark had just read that, and he joined the idea of the Mystery of Capital and joined that with the concept of smart contracts. And so his point was that you could do all of this in code, and that actually the countries that don't necessarily have this good legal infrastructure might be good places to start because they can kind of leapfrog. Whereas in a place like the United States that does have all this infrastructure might be really slow to change. And so I really recommend the paper. It's an amazing paper still, but it was written before the concept of a smart contract on a blockchain had really come to pass.
And by the way, in the show notes section, we'll have all of these resources mentioned in the podcast listed.
So what to you would be the essence of a smart contract? Is it that it's executed on the blockchain? Is it something about the programmatic specification? You know, smart contracts seems like they're defined almost in opposition to dumb contracts or legal contracts or some other kind of contract. What's the salient difference? What's new?
Well, I think this is a very contested concept. So going back to kind of Nick Szabo and Mark Miller and Ian Grigg's definitions of a smart contract, I think there was definitely a smart contract was intended to replace some of the same functionality that a legal contract would give you. So it's really an arrangement of an agreement in code that's enforced in code. Whereas I think when Vitalik introduced Ethereum around 2014 or so, he expressed a smart contract as more of just kind of an agent of code that runs on a blockchain. So I think there's kind of two very separate ideas there. And in fact, like if you go to the Ethereum documentation now, it just says a smart contract is code that runs on a blockchain. But at Agoric, we were very tied to that kind of that original vision where a smart contract isn't necessarily a legal contract, but it's trying to perform some of the same functionality. And so it's not merely just code on a blockchain, even though a blockchain is an incredible environment to run a smart contract on because of the higher integrity and, you know, the guarantee that, you know, for the most part, that people aren't manipulating how it's run. But we really go back to the concept of a smart contract as being enforcing an arrangement among people.
So how do you see this being used in the wild?
Yeah, well, I think it's still the very early stages. But I can mention what I think is kind of the most basic, but still the most revolutionary use case. So going back to Hobbes, and I think it was like the 1600s, there was this issue of how if you're making a simple trade with someone, whichever party performs their action first. So let's say we're just, you know, swapping one item for another item. If I give my item to you, then you could run away with both of them. Historically, there's been this huge social problem of not being able to trust other people enough to actually have secure exchange. And there's this, I don't know if you guys have seen the Raiders of the Lost Ark recently, but there's this great part where Indiana Jones is trying to cross this pit. And one of his like helpers is on the other side and he has this idol. And, you know, the helper is like, well, give me the idol and then I'll give you the, you know, the rope to allow you to pass. And so Indiana Jones does. And of course, the guy runs off with like both idols, right? So, you know, going back to Indiana Jones as well, it's this huge social problem. And so I think the very simple thing that smart contracts are able to do that is really revolutionary from just a societal perspective is being able to make swaps and exchanges secure. So in our system, you know, smart contracts are able to hold or own items. So instead of actually having to have like a human being be the escrow service, you can send the items to a smart contract. Then the smart contract, once it gets both of the items, can actually disperse them. And so at no point are you trusting the other party to like maintain their promise. You're just trusting in the code.
So it sounds like a key piece here is this secure atomic exchange.
Yeah.
But one challenge in dealing with contracts is that you might not trust their code. You might not be able to read it or be able to audit it. Or even if the person who wrote the code was honest, they might have made a mistake. So does Agoric try to help address this or help to make it safer for people who want secure exchange to use different contracts? And if so, how?
Yeah, so that's definitely a huge problem. And we've seen, you know, millions of dollars being lost in smart contracts just because of a simple error. And I think in 2018, there was this great paper, I think it was called Finding Greedy, Prodigal, and Suicidal Contracts at Scale. And basically what they did was that they identified all of these problematic contracts or symptoms of a problematic contract. So like, for instance, a greedy contract is a contract that holds the funds, or like the funds are locked up in the contract and no one can get them, which is usually a sign of something bad happening. Prodigal is that the contract gives the funds to some random third party, which may be an attacker, but, you know, probably not a good sign either. And then suicidal is that all these contracts that they are analyzing were on Ethereum, and this would just call the suicide call. So they identified all of these problematic contracts, and they were able to use symbolic execution to find them and then verify that they were correctly identified. But this paper was kind of a wake-up call for us at Agoric, just given the scale of how many problematic contracts there were. Mark Miller, our chief scientist, down this route of trying to figure out how to solve that problem. And so the solution that he came up with was what we call Zoe. So what Zoe is, it's a smart contract itself, but it allows us to separate the concerns. So I almost view it as like the credit card processing entity for like e-commerce or something like that. Like, obviously it's not that, but the same kind of model where it's like someone who's just creating their, you know, knitting website or something shouldn't have to worry about credit card processing, right? Someone else can do that. And so what Zoe does is it escrows all of the underlying assets that you might want to create a smart contract from, and then it also handles the dispersal. So we can go more in depth on that. But I think the most important thing that came out of that was the separation of concerns, such that the smart contract that, you know, your average developer is writing never actually touches the underlying assets. And so it can't actually lock them up and become a greedy contract. You can't send them to a random person. And, you know, the suicidal part is kind of it's the same thing as the greedy contract. But fundamentally, the reason why we're able to do that is because we have this concept that we call offers. It's an expression of user intent, which we never really had in smart contracts before. But what it says is that it's basically just an object that has properties that are wanted and properties that are offered. And so I'm saying, let's say I'm going to make up some fake money here, but like, you know, I have 3 moolah and I want to exchange them for 7 simoleons, right? That's what we call an offer. So I'm stating what I have, what I'm willing to offer, and what I want. We have this property that we call offer safety. And what offer safety says is that a user who uses a smart contract that runs on Zoe is guaranteed to either get what they said that they wanted or get a full refund. So in that way, we're able to guarantee that the contract isn't able to lock up the funds.
Makes sense. Who's a user? Am I a user or other contracts users?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think for the most part, I've been designing this such that there are really 2 different user types. One is the smart contract developer that just wants to write their auction or, you know, whatever it is, and they want to do so in a way that hopefully won't hurt their users or, you know, leave themselves vulnerable to being attacked. So that's one kind of user audience, as someone who's just using the Zoe API and creating their own smart contract. The other is the end user who, you know, may trust Zoe, but they may not trust the smart contract developer to have done everything right. And so we wanted to partition the risk so that for that end user who's, you know, so we have a version of Uniswap that we call AutoSwap. So let's say someone's going on the AutoSwap or Uniswap website and they just want to exchange, you know, one type of cryptocurrency for another. We want to make sure that that person is guaranteed to either, you know, get what they said that they wanted or get a full refund back. So that's where the offer safety comes in.
How does Zoe reason about escrowing physical goods, such as the knitted goods example that you mentioned?
Yeah. So right now, Zoe cannot really do much of anything with physical goods. So one example that we've explored is like a digital art gallery or something like that. And there you're really trusting the entity that is able to verify that the physical goods match whatever digital assets it's creating. So, you know, there's definitely not a fully permissionless or decentralized approach. You're really trusting one entity. So Zoe does not do anything special with physical goods. The credit card processing was more of an example of the type of service that we hope Zoe can be.
The physical enforcement is at least possible in principle, right? I guess you'd have a Terminator robot running around with a Tendermint-like client, you know, scanning the state of Zoe, seeing who owns which knitted good. And if someone takes it, enacting punishment, right? I mean, this is the role of, we've just switched the ledger, but if that were some piece of paper in the back of a knitting shop where the old grandma was enforcing the law, we've just changed the entities. It's still possible. Is that right?
I think there's a lot to explore there for sure. I think the place to really start is with digital assets. So with cryptocurrencies, with things that can mostly be represented digitally, like maybe event tickets. But, you know, finding that mapping to the real world assets and how to enforce that, I think, is still a big unsolved problem.
So the one I want to enforce is not knitted patterns. It's nuclear arms control. That will have to wait. I agree.
But currently, escrowing of homes is done more or less digitally through, I guess, paperwork. But could we sort of transpose some of that responsibility onto Zoe?
I think it really depends on who you're trusting. So, like, the thing about Zoe is that it doesn't depend on any kind of legal infrastructure or trusting any third party in how it operates. So if you're operating purely with digital assets like cryptocurrencies, you can have assurances that the invariant of offer safety is going to hold. If you're dealing with physical assets, even though offer safety may hold with the digital representation of those physical assets, I think, you know, there's still a danger that, for instance, with let's say a physical house, like maybe the previous tenants won't actually move out or something like that, right? So I think you don't have the same level of guarantees that things will actually work out in the way that you intend that you do with purely digital assets.
So you talked a little bit about thinking about contract developers. How will contract developers use Zoe? Is it a library, a blockchain? What kinds of environments will it be available on? Can they get started today?
So it's currently available on our testnet. We have an invite-only testnet that's up that is running on the Cosmos SDK, as well as our own, what we call it, SwingSet environment, which is basically a VM on top of Cosmos or on top of Tendermint. So yeah, so in terms of being a smart contract developer, there is, like, Zoe and our smart contracts are literally just JavaScript code. So our hope is that there are long-lasting Zoe entities that have a well-known identity, so that when you're interacting with a smart contract, you first start off interacting with a Zoe in our environment. And that's kind of your starting point in terms of, you know, where your trust is located. And then from there, you can install code on Zoe. So, like, if I'm writing, let's say, a very simple exchange that's just kind of a very naive one where the order book is just an array that is looked into for matches. If I'm writing that up, it's just JavaScript code. And then I install that on Zoe and get an instance ID from Zoe. And then from there, I can send invites to other people. I can post this identity and allow other people to join. So for right now, it's pretty much familiar to someone who has a JavaScript development background. It's really only the deployment process to put it on the testnet that's different.
Right. So just to satiate my curiosity, what is this identity? Is this some sort of object reference that now references a Zoe instance on the testnet? Is that right?
Yeah. So in JavaScript terms, it's an empty object that we use as a unique identifier that's unforgeable. And by unforgeable, we mean, so like if it was, let's say, you know, just a number, you know, an ID of one, like you might see in a traditional database, then obviously that's forgeable. I can, you know, just try numbers until something works. And so part of our development background is what we call object capabilities. And so having unique identifiers that are unforgeable, like we do in JavaScript with just using plain JavaScript objects that are empty as an identity, really helps us.
In the context of object capabilities. Maybe you could shed some more light on that. There's been some noise in the ecosystem about OCaps. Maybe we could educate our listeners about what that is and how that relates to current access control in smart contracts in the ecosystem, like in Ethereum, for example. The example I keep going back to is the DAO reentrancy bug. Mm-hmm. And while it doesn't map one-to-one to how object capability sort of mitigates that, but I would like to know a little bit more about how OCaps is more secure than what's currently in the ecosystem.
So first, let me back up a bit. So in every application, there's what we call authority, right? There's the ability to do something. So if I'm, you know, just writing like a Node application or something, some of the things that I might have access to are like the file system built in Node module, or maybe like access to the network or something like that. And so the thing about object capabilities is it allows you to enforce what we call POLA, or the principle of least authority. And what that says is that you should only grant your code the authority that's necessary and no more. So, you know, if your code doesn't actually need the file system, and I'm still talking about typical development here, not smart contract or blockchain development, but if your code doesn't need the file system, then you shouldn't give it access to it. It's a very different paradigm than what we're used to. And a lot of things like, you know, what I just mentioned with how Node allows you to just kind of access the file system willy-nilly, or allow packages to access the file system willy-nilly, is directly in conflict with POLA, or the principle of least authority. So bringing that into the blockchain ecosystem, what that means is that patterns in Ethereum, like only owner, or looking at like who sent a transaction to see if they have the authority to do something, that is also contrary to object capabilities. And so what object capabilities is it's expressing the granting of authority by expressing it in terms of objects, so that there's no list of who can do what. The question is, do you actually have the object that has the method on it that allows you to do something? So it's kind of more like a car key in that regard. So you can imagine, like, if your car didn't work with keys, but instead had a list of like everyone who was allowed to drive it, you know, whenever someone else wanted to drive it, you would have to add them to the list. If you took it to like, you know, valet parking, you would have to add the valet guy to the list or something like that. And then if he goes off duty, then how do you handle the new guy coming in? Do you give like admin access to the valet when you first arrive so that he can pass it off to someone else? So like there are all of these issues that come up with a typical access control, with access control lists, where it's not clear whether someone needs, you know, someone can delegate it, whether someone needs like admin status to do so. There are just all these problems. And so what object capabilities does is it puts things in terms of objects. And if you actually have the object, or you have the authority to do something, you can go ahead and use that. And you can also do what we call attenuate, or kind of minimize the authority, and then pass that on to someone else. I like using the file system as an example for this, but let's say like this code only needs access to a particular file, and it only needs append access. So I could create an object that gets passed into code that only has access to that and doesn't need access to the whole file system. So that's kind of a background on object capabilities, but it's a really cool paradigm that allows you to think about access control in a different way. And I think that makes things a lot easier to use. And because it's easy to use, it makes things more secure.
So if we tie it back to the paradigm in smart contracts on Ethereum, what would the object be? Like, would the smart contract be the car or the key, or is there not even this notion of an object and it's something else entirely?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I have to say, I have not thought about how to change Solidity contracts to fit an object capability paradigm. I can tell you how our contracts work and how that might be a little bit different. So like, for instance, we have the concept of invites to join contracts, and invites are actually, they're actually payments in our electronic rights transfer protocol, ERTP, which is kind of our, you can think of it as like the ERC20 or ERC721 or what is it, 1155, like our standardized version of all of those things. And so if someone has an invite to join the contract, that means that we don't have to look up their identity or their public key or whatever to see if they have the authority to join the contract. they have an invite. So if they choose to send us that invite, then they will be able to use the contract. And so it's really about putting the authority into objects or tokens and not having lists of people who are or not approved to do certain things.
Right. So in the future, somebody who just deployed a Zoe contract who has not received an invite to another smart contract would not be able to access any parts of the contract they were not explicitly invited to.
Correct. Yeah.
So something like a, you know, introducing a reentrancy bug through another smart contract would not be possible.
So reentrancy, I think, is a problem that we have a good solution for, but I think our solution is a little bit different. So reentrancy happens, right, when you're going through code, you call out to something else, and then the code that you call out to is able to reenter that particular function kind of unexpectedly. And, you know, like in Ethereum world, right, like that can mean that, you know, payments are being sent out when you thought that they weren't, you know, terrible things like that, right? And so what we're able to do is that we really rely on the event loop architecture of JavaScript. And so that we know that within a certain function, if there are no asynchronous calls, then we know that that's perfectly synchronous. And that if we call another function, it'll not actually be executed. So that's how we solve reentrancy, is by relying on kind of like the event loop architecture that allows us to really clearly separate when we're giving access to other functions or, you know, code that we may not trust.
One of the benefits of working within the Ethereum ecosystem is that you have interoperability across these smart contracts because of, I guess, a lack of object capabilities. But how does Zoe retain that interoperability functionality?
Yeah, I think we have a really different view than Ethereum developers. So, you know, Ethereum kind of really started with this very local synchronous communication between contracts. We've kind of started from the opposite perspective, where especially with Cosmos, we're going to be living in a world of many different blockchains that are going to be communicating with each other. And, you know, there may be things such as sharding that Ethereum 2.0 is moving to. So we're going to have this world of asynchrony. We need to figure out how to be able to have contracts that interact with that. So we've really built up this distributed system with asynchronous calls, not the like synchronous calls that are familiar on Ethereum. That helps us with reentrancy hazards, but we also think it's more similar to the real world, right? Like if you are a developer trying to buy up land, for instance, let's say you want to build like a shopping mall or something like that, you may not be able to buy all of the land all at once. You may have to buy certain ones. You may have to buy what they call options, or like the right to make a purchase. And so there are different ways that people have come up with in real life to be able to kind of like solve the problem of purchasing things or like making actions over time. And one of those things is you can buy options. You can buy the right to buy something at a future point. And then once you've collected all the options, then you can synchronously make a decision to go forward and purchase those things. So that's kind of the approach that we take with Zoe.
So speaking of blockchains, what do you expect will become of this testnet? Will it turn into a mainnet or mainnets? How will sort of the Agoric runtime and Zoe end up interacting with the Cosmos ecosystem or the wider Interchain ecosystem?
We're definitely hoping for this testnet to turn into a mainnet at some point in the next year or so. And I think right now, Zoe is kind of at a higher level than any of the IBC interaction. Once we have a token on our chain that is actually a peg of something that exists on another chain, then Zoe will be able to interact with that digital asset just like it interacts with anything else. So we're hoping to really have good isolation and abstraction in terms of the concepts so that Zoe doesn't need to know about anything IBC related necessarily, because we're already building in a system that assumes asynchrony, if that makes sense.
If we zoom the clock forward a year, maybe two, and there is an interchain, IBC is running, there are many blockchains connected in Agoric's mainnet with Zoe or supporting contracts written in Zoe is part of that. What role do you imagine it will serve? Is it sort of like a particular legal jurisdiction which executes contracts? Does that play well to the strengths of the object capability infrastructure you're working on? Does it have a particular application? What do you envision?
Anyone who's building, let's say, like a Uniswap or something like that, I think they will really want to use Zoe because their customers or their users will probably demand it. Because given the choice of interacting with a smart contract where like, oh, it may lock up all your funds, or, you know, oh, it may send all your funds to someone else, maybe an attacker, a smart contract that's written on Zoe will be able to guarantee offer safety, as I mentioned earlier, and what we call payout liveness, that you'll actually get a payout within a certain time period. So there, I think there's a huge advantage for someone who's trying to build a business out of writing smart contracts like Uniswap or what have you, because their users will be protected. So they can say, if I'm writing the smart contract, even if I mess up, you're still protected to a certain extent. You'll at least get what you said you wanted, or you'll get a refund. Like, I, as the smart contract developer, I still may make a mistake. Like, if I'm writing an auction, maybe, you know, the wrong person is chosen as the winner. Maybe my auction logic is slightly wrong, but at least you won't lose your money if you use my contract. So I think what we're really hoping is that this will make things much, much easier for smart contract developers, and that the users can feel secure, that there's kind of this safety net that's protecting them, where if Zoe is written correctly, they can't lose all of their money in the same way that they can with other contracts.
Sounds reassuring. I admit I am pretty terrified every time I interact with a smart contract. It'd be nice to be, sleep a little easier at night. Are there any particular applications or particular contracts, either currently existing or not yet currently existing, that you would like to see?
I think what I'm really interested in, or one of the things that I'm really interested in, is contracts for public goods. There's a concept known as dominant assurance contracts that purports to be a way that to incentivize people to create public goods or to fund public goods. So it's almost like a Kickstarter in that way. But there's mechanism design that actually makes it worthwhile to participate in, even if the good isn't actually made because the goal wasn't met. So I'm really excited about dominant assurance contracts. I think that would be really interesting. I think the other thing that I'm really interested in, and this is more of a long shot, like I could see the dominant assurance contract being written, I don't know, a month from now or something like that. That seems pretty straightforward. But more of a long shot, I think, is fulfilling a part of legal contracts that we haven't been able to do so far, and that's obligations. So like right now in the smart contracts on our system and in most smart contract platforms, you really have to like either escrow something. I guess on Ethereum, you can like approve something to be withdrawn, but you still have to guarantee that it'll be there, right, in your account. But mostly we're relying on escrow, right, to be able to ensure that we can actually make a payment. We have to escrow something in a smart contract. I'm really interested in non-escrowed smart contracts. So like, is there a way that you could say, I am willing to pay this in the future, like a subscription service, and I don't have the money now, but like, I'm promising you that I will. There's a lot to explore there. Maybe that means like that you have club membership or something, and that the club will pay if you're not able to. Maybe that means some type of insurance that you buy. Someone else will pay on your behalf if you're not able to. So I'm really curious about that. And that kind of seems to be, for the most part, uncharted territory, except although people have been trying to make subscription services and things like that. But this concept of being able to promise things that don't involve escrow, but involve other kinds of obligations, and actually be able to have credible commitments that those promises will be kept, I think is really, really interesting.
You said something interesting earlier that I want to sort of go back to, which is the mechanism designed for a Kickstarter application. Could you kind of extrapolate on that?
It's mostly designed for what they call public goods in economics. So public goods, they are non-rivalrous. So like if I use it, I'm not preventing someone else from using it. They are non-excludable. So like a good example of a public good might be national defense or something like that. If someone doesn't pay for national defense, you can't exclude them from it. So let's see, non-rivalness, non-excludable. I'm missing the third thing. Do you know, Chris?
I mean, I don't know the third bullet. One thing that's usually true is that that like marginal utility to an individual, if they were only paying for it, would be much lower than the benefit they gain.
Yeah. Let's see. Another example of a public good would be like asteroid deterrence or something. If an asteroid was going to hit the Earth, you know, people would want to prevent that from happening. But if you didn't actually pay into the asteroid deterrence funds, the outcome would basically be the same, right? So there's the incentive to be a free rider for public goods. Dominant assurance contract, or actually it started out just as an assurance contract, was a way to say, here's how we can incentivize people to fund public goods if they wouldn't otherwise fund them. And it's kind of a Kickstarter model where if the goal isn't met, then people actually get their money back.
But how does this mitigate the free riding incentive?
It may be that the free riding is still able to happen, but that people are incentivized to fund it anyways. And I can't remember exactly why, but it's an open area of research that I think is really cool. And it seems like it'd be pretty easy to actually code up. It's something that Vitalik's mentioned in the past, I think. So that's one of the things that I'd love to be able to work on in my spare time, I think.
Yeah, I'm super excited about funding public goods too. Have you heard of liberal radicalism?
Yeah,
do you have
yeah.
any thoughts on that?
Wait, before we talk about the thoughts on that, can we explain what that is?
Yeah, I can give a very quick explanation with the caveat that I'm not an expert, but primarily liberal radicalism tries to solve the marginal utility problem. It assumes that you have some public good and tries to allow private actors making individual decisions without the ability to sort of collectively commit contingent on each other's actions to individually fund a public good by having some funding provider sort of top up the difference in a way such that it makes sense for the individuals. So to like concretize it a bit, if the public good is a road, just as an individual deciding to pay for maintenance of the road, usually if I spend money, I'm not getting anything close to my money's worth in utility back because most of the utility the road is providing is to other people, not to me. And liberal radicalism basically adds a funder into this equation so that when I spend a dollar to improve this road, maybe I only get 10 cents of utility, but then this other funder adds another $10. And so now I get a dollar of utility. So now just on my own, even without anyone else paying with me, it's in my interest to pay for the road because this funder will match it with leverage. That's the basic idea.
And who would funder be in this construct?
It could be inflation on a blockchain, the community pool.
I think I hadn't actually heard about it, at least under this term. That sounds very close to the dominant assurance contract, which I think also requires a funder to actually make the payouts. If the goal isn't met, I think people get actually something on top of what they put in back. So that would require a funder as well.
What sorts of public goods do you think blockchain should fund?
Oh, that's a very good question. I kind of go back to like mutual aid societies, which we've kind of lost. So like there used to be all of these community organizations that you could join where you are a group of people. It may be like a men's organization or something, maybe like a tradesman's organization, but you're a group of people, you go in together and you kind of provide insurance to each other. So like if a particular family gets sick or someone, one of the tradesmen gets injured or something like that, you would take the community funds and those would go to help them. That kind of seems like low-hanging fruit for a blockchain solution because it's all funding. And so it's kind of like if you had almost like a DAO plus just cryptocurrencies, you would be able to do that sort of thing. The public goods that are harder to do on a blockchain are the more physical or the more, you know, the ones that actually take interacting with people in the real world. The mutual aid society kind of stuff seems like a low-hanging fruit.
I'm really interested in going back to that, the topic of public goods, because while we're thinking about public goods in the sense that people are sort of altruistically funding for this thing that everybody's going to be using, where does private funding for this come in? And could people potentially privatize the building of roads for their own benefit or for their own like local neighborhood, for example?
You want it to be as privately funded as possible. The only issue is I think what Chris was bringing up where people aren't necessarily incentivized to fund it if they're not getting huge benefits back. the hard part of the mechanism design is figuring out how to actually make it incentive compatible for them to be funding it. And that's a really hard thing to do, but it seems like there are some promising solutions.
It's a fun thing to think about, because what happens if there's a road with a bunch of potholes, for example, and there's a bunch of homes that use this road more often than anyone else does? And so would these people be more incentivized to just privately fund this and cover up the potholes if it would get the job done earlier? And what happens to those people who then just sort of free ride on the road, but maybe they cross it once in their lifetimes and don't use it any other times?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I know in like New York City and other places, they've actually kind of solved the problem of the non-excludable prong of the test for public goods. If you're going to go into New York City, you have to pay a fee to be able to go into New York City if you're driving a car. And they're able to combat congestion that way by, like, you know, raising and lowering the price appropriately. The solution to this is going to be some kind of toll booth or a gate or something that actually allows you to exclude people who are not willing to be part of the community or, you know, pay the price that's associated with using the road. That's part of the way that people are able to solve one of the problems of public goods, is to try to take one of those characteristics of public goods and see if they can actually change that by, you know, taking it from non-excludable to excludable or and so forth.
So essentially privatizing public goods.
Yeah.
I'm all for that.
It seems like a very specific solution. It works in the case of roads. I suppose I'm thinking about the case of digital goods, that some of which we're authoring themselves, or, you know, smart contracts, blockchain software, because an essential component of this for users to be able to use it and trust it and interact with it is that it's open source or publicly readable. It's very, very hard to exclude while preserving that. We've tried this in other domains of information with certain kinds of intellectual property law, which work or don't work to varying degrees. It seems like currently the mode of thinking and blockchain is just not to do it at all, make everything open source and kind of try to find funding somehow or create tokens, that sort of thing. I don't know if I think that's a good strategy or not. Do you have any thoughts?
One of the things that sort of pops up in my mind is this notion of productizing something built on top of the public goods that other people have built. One example would be all of the goods that Linus built, and then Google was able to take a lot of that and then build products on top of it and create, you know, multi-billion dollar industry on top of it. So could it just be that open source could remain open source and free? Meanwhile, if you wanted to capitalize on some of the value from it, you'd have to create a product.
I think productizing is definitely one of the ways forward that, you know, we've seen work in the past. One of the things that I'm interested in is, and I don't know if I've actually been able to think this out thoroughly, so I'm kind of thinking it through as I'm saying it, but if you're using open source code, part of being a good part of that community and a good part of that society is by contributing back to it as you can, right? So if you're a huge company and you're using open source code, you should probably be contributing to that, or, you know, paying for the development, something like that. There's like reputation forces as well that could incentivize people to support open source code. And I could see this being applicable in a blockchain space, not in terms of human readable identity necessarily, but if I see that someone has, let's say, created a new instance of my contract on Zoe, then maybe, you know, the person who originally created that installation or, you know, uploaded that code should receive some kind of payback. Reputation and what it means to actually be a good community member can also be a pressure here that may incentivize people to pay. And part of that could be actually encoded in how people use the libraries that other people have made.
How do we create reputation without turning the system into a social credit system?
I've also been thinking, like, you don't want to have an exact count of your reputation points either, because then you could, you know, choose to like spend them all in and do something terrible. Like, you really want it to be a very fuzzy metric, like it is in real life, where you don't want to do something that would offend someone else or wrong someone else. first, because it would be wrong, but like, secondly, in terms of your reputation, you really don't know what effect it would have. If we did have a system where there were very concrete scores for your reputation, that could actually create huge problems, and that people may choose to do something that would be bad, knowing that the reputation will only suffer by a couple of points or something like that. Like, it could allow people to game the system more. So I think there are a lot of really unanswered questions when it comes to whether it's even a good idea to try to create concrete reputation metrics.
Just to touch one, I think, recurrent theme in this conversation has been that there's a lot of existing literature on smart contracts, on public good problems, on reputation systems, perhaps. Certainly our human reputation systems have been going on for as long as we've been a species, one would presume, or at least had some sort of language. I'm sure they persisted to some degree before then. Are there particular parts, other parts, or deeper areas within these elements that we've already touched upon of the literature in legal theory, political economics, public choice, that you think the blockchain space would benefit from, maybe that it's not aware of at the moment or not widely aware of?
I can give you some of my favorite papers. One of my favorite papers is this one by Anthony Cronman. He was the dean of Yale Law School, but he has this great paper called Contracts in the State of Nature, and he tries to imagine what kind of agreements and enforcement mechanisms you might have outside of the current legal system. So he goes into, like, I think, four different kinds of enforcement mechanisms. And it's really interesting to think about that in terms of how could you actually carry some of these things over to the blockchain ecosystem? And that could be the solution for not using escrow and being able to enforce agreements that don't actually include escrow. So that would be one of the papers. My second recommendation isn't actually a paper at all. It's a book by Jillian Hadfield. And basically, she goes over the history of law and economics and what she calls, or what is known in that area as private ordering. So that's like, how do people, going back to like the California Gold Rush and other things, how did people actually create order for themselves outside of intact legal state? That's really, really interesting. She's a law professor who's now been doing a lot of work in law and AI. And so she's coming from a background that is both very much in the legal world and also a little bit in the tech world as well. The book is called Rules for a Flat World.
One final quick question. Where can developers find the code? Does Agoric have a GitHub, I presume?
The best place to look for our code is on the Agoric GitHub. Zoe is currently in the ERTP repo. We're moving to a mono repo, which I don't know if anyone's done that yet. This is my first time going through this process. So things may be in flux. Make sure that all of the forwards work correctly. The ERTP repo has both Zoe and our electronic rights transfer protocol.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, listeners, for listening in to the very second Interchain FM podcast.